The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
I'm honored to have been invited to introduce our authors this evening. My name is Tom Klein. Before I begin my introduction, please indulge me to share with you some thoughts I have about the Free Library of Philadelphia and the transformation that is happening here and in libraries around the country and in libraries around the world. Once a great repository of information and resources, the Free Library is becoming one of our community's most vital service organizations. Its thousands of programs literally serve millions annually. Literacy, homework help, mentoring, nutrition, healthcare screenings, connections to healthcare providers, cooking classes, prison services, job readiness, small business resources, access to computers and specialists, the list goes on and on. Libraries are inclusive places where anyone can go, no matter your age, your background, your economic, or even your citizenship status. The library is the most important democratic organization in our community, serving all who enter while also reaching out to serve those who either are disenfranchised or feel disenfranchised. The library provides a safe place for civil dialogue. Libraries encourage and host conversations about complex social issues. The library exists to provide opportunities for discussion, supported by educational resources, access to a vast array of information and ideas that transform communities, open minds, and yes, promote inclusion and respect. This is a critical time in our lives, bringing social and equal justice to citizens, to all citizens, is of paramount importance. The Free Library of Philadelphia is committed to these goals. I hope you will continue to use the library's resources and will connect with them if you are able, and connect with them to support the library if you are able. And now about the authors. It gives me great pleasure to introduce humanitarian and former President of the United States, William Jefferson Clinton, and the world's best leading and best-selling author, James Patterson. Bill Clinton was elected president, it seems so long ago, and so far away, in 1992. After two successful terms as president of the United States, he established the Clinton Foundation, which improves lives across the United States and around the world by working with partners to create economic opportunity, improve public health, inspire civic engagement, and inspire service. He is the author of several nonfiction works, including My Life, which was a number one international bestseller. The President is Missing. What a title. What a title. The President is Missing is his first novel. Or is it? James Patterson received the Literarian Award for Outstanding Service to the American Literary Community from the National Book Foundation. His books have sold more than, think about this, 375 million copies worldwide. Here are two things, yes. Yeah. Not one of the great ones here tonight for us, two of the great ones, and yet a third for me to talk about. Here are just two things about Mr. Patterson which you may not know. A tireless champion of the power of books and reading. He has donated more than 1 million books to students and soldiers, and he funds over 400 teacher education scholarships at 24 colleges and universities. And fact two, among many of which you may not know, he has also donated millions of dollars to independent bookstores and school libraries. Tonight, the authors will discuss their novel, The President Is Missing, offering their insights into the unique collaboration that they have had, their unique research, as well as the timely and, yes, alarming, issues their novel raises about our world today. This book marks the first time a president of the United States has collaborated with a best-selling novelist on a world of fiction. And if that weren't enough, as they say, their talk tonight will be in a conversation with Lee Child. Internationally celebrated author of the number one bestseller Jack Reacher thriller series. So we have a lot going on. We are so pleased to have them all with us tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming former President of the United States Bill Clinton, James Patterson, and Lee Child.
Okay, I'm Lee Child, and I'm going to be asking these two the questions, and that is a very tempting prospect. They've got to answer what I ask them. But to set the scene about this book, we got to point out that you were already a huge thriller fan. You're extensively read in the genre, so this was not your first experience of the thriller world.
No, I've read every book you ever wrote, and so has Jim, and we like them a lot. But I love thrillers. I started reading them probably in earnest more than 35 years ago, and I find them both a release and also a pretty good window on human psychology and what motivates people. And the best written ones are quite exceptional works of literature, I think. So I've always loved them, and I wanted to write one, but I never got around to it. So we have the same lawyer / agent who's our friend, Bob Barnett, and he came to me and he said, "You're never going to do this, so why don't you write one with James Patterson?" And I'd met Jim before and liked him very much, but I said, "Now, why would he do that?"
You know, and why I would do it was both the president and I grew up in small towns, and in my small town, nobody ever came there. But when I was 7 or 8 years old, President Eisenhower came, and I never forgot. You know, I never got within 300 feet of him, but I never forgot seeing President Eisenhower. So the notion of spending a year and writing a book with President Clinton was irresistible to me. Great honor, great opportunity, stress-making situation, great challenge. Not because of the president, just because of the expectations that I knew that the novel would have.
So I heard, I know many of the writers that you've collaborated with before, and they all reported as a very positive experience, but they also report the clear dynamic that you're in charge. It's an atelier system. You're the old master. You're in charge of what goes on.
That was the other challenge. I'm not in charge anymore.
Exactly. I want to know, how did that work out?
I'm the minion. No, it really wasn't like that. It was a joyful experience. And, you know, to me, if you're going to get together on something like this, and I wish it would happen in Congress, you need to start with mutual respect, and then you have to listen. And that's what we did. We had mutual respect, and then we listened, and listened, and listened, and, you know.
So was it a face-to-face thing, or phone, or email, or back and forth, or what?
Yes.
Well, we had a lot of talks on the phone. We had some meetings, and we exchanged drafts the whole time. Every single page went back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. Some were rewritten many times, but we started off, you know, first of all, I asked Jonathan, how do you do this? He said, I start with an outline, and it's like a skeleton, and then I put flesh on the bones. And I liked it because the way this book was written was kind of like a good jazz piece. You know, you've got the tune and you've got the key. And you play the melody, and then you have to ad lib a little to make it interesting, to make the people real. And so not very long after we started, he gave me a list of 20 questions, because I said, and he agreed, that if we were going to do this together, it had to be authentic, realistic, at least as applied to the standards that existed up to that time when we started. About how the White House works, what, you know, just how it works.
Yeah, the challenge of writing a realistic novel about the president has gotten a lot harder recently.
There were, you know, generally accepted kind of things about how the White House should work, and that it really does matter who works there and what they know and what their skills are. And I believe that diverse groups make better decisions than homogenous ones. And I remember the first week I was in office, because I had an unusually young staff, I brought them in the Oval Office, like 30 of them. And I said, look, if anybody ever comes in here and tells me what they have already decided they think I want to hear, I might as well get rid of all of you and run this place with a computer. That no one will ever be demoted or fired or iced out for telling me what I don't want to hear. We want to know what you think and what you know. And if you find, so we tried to create both factually and in terms of the context, a realistic environment, and then answer the questions, including how the president goes missing, in the most realistic possible way to deal with something we hope you will find thrilling, but is a real big problem, which is cybersecurity. And it goes way beyond elections. We decided to start to do this book in 2016, before the election. And one of the things that I worry about is I hear all this debate, and whether you think it's a big deal that the Russians hacked our election or not may depend on who you voted for. But
it's very hard for Lee, because we're answering his questions before he gets to ask.
Yeah, but I mean, that's really something I want you to think about. If you read the book, we try to do a serious book that would also be interesting.
Sure. And the name of the titular president is Duncan, which is a two-syllable name ending in N. And the middle name is a legendary president. And the first name, Jonathan, fairly conventional name like William. So who came up with the name for the character?
I never know who comes up with anything, honestly. It's always a back and forth, and who came up with the title, who knows, who cares. It really was a great collaboration, and I think one of the things for both of us, I mean, it's just been a fun experience. We've had a great time with it, and we have a great time coming out and seeing people. I mean, this is a joy for us. This is a great room, by the way. Go Eagles. Yeah. 76ers, too.
So So the story is, we're not going to give away too much of the story because some of you won't have read the book yet and we don't want to spoil the surprises, but the president disappears from public view because of the crisis that he's got to handle. And with an audience this size, we thought it would be impractical to have live audience questions because it takes too long. So I've got all the audience questions here. They've submitted in advance. And many, many, many of them, including, if I can read it, Ian Manor, who is 7 years old, wanted to know, did you ever go missing?
Well,
is that a feasible thing?
My critics often earnestly hoped I would. But no, I didn't. It's not as easy as it sounds. That the Secret Service, quick synopsis, the Secret Service provides protection for the president and the members of the president's family and a number of other people on a more or less continuous basis. The law provides that other people, not the president, can actually waive it for a period of time. You can sign off. And, you know, think about your own life. There might be 1,000 reasons you just say, look, I like one day when there wasn't somebody following me around and I will assume the risk. The president really can't do that, but there is a semi-provision. We deal with this in the book, but you can do it in fact for a little bit. So we try to tell you how it can be done and then how you actually physically, how you would go about doing it. But I never did it. And even though there were times I wished I could be alone, the Secret Service was really good to Hillary and me and Chelsea about not staying even in the stairwell of the residential floors, the top two floors of the White House, so we could have family time and wander around and, you know, feel like we were halfway normal. Halfway being the operative word, I think.
And Jim, as we heard, I mean, you've sold more books than probably anybody. Did you learn something specifically from this particular one?
I learned a lot of things. I mean, one of the things is just how there are two. Somebody at a certain point, people have talked about this being a beach read, which it is. And I raise a question, or we both raise a question, can a beach read also be somewhat important? And I think they can be. And there are two important things about this book, in the president, in my opinion, and you'll draw your own conclusions. One is, for 20, 25 years, we've been making fun of the presidency. Saturday Night Live, Scandal, House of Cards, whatever. And that's healthy to a certain extent, except when people start believing that it's not an important job. It's hugely important, hugely stressful, and this is something that I learned how stressful it is. It never stops coming at you. The importance of it is it's just mammoth in our world and getting more important every day. And so we have to be so careful, in my opinion, on our opinion, in terms of who we elect. I'm not being political here. But it's such a vital job, even as we look at the midterms coming up, so important who we elect, who we put into the Congress, because these jobs are just so important. So that's one piece of it, just to remind people, to put a president out there who you go, yeah, this guy should be president. Duncan should be president. He's a good human being. He's tough. He's the kind of guy, yes, this is the kind of person that we would like. The second piece is the cyber terrorism. And the more we found out about it, and the president knew a lot about it already, but as he kept reading, and both of us kept reading, you know, we have a defense budget right now, and it's getting bigger. It's a huge defense budget. Very little of it is put against cyber terrorism, and that, in our opinion, is a mistake. Because that cyber terrorism is probably the greatest threat we have. And when you read this book, I think it's the scariest thriller I've ever been involved with. I love the Reacher books. I love them. But this is scarier than the Reacher books. I mean, it's really, really frightening. And what happens in this book could happen.
Yeah, I mean, it totally could. And you were at the very beginning of that prior to the millennium, all that millennium stuff with computers. I assume that there are things that we don't know, that you know, and I assume that there are things that are not in this book, scary as it is, because otherwise it would be too panic-inducing.
Well, that's a fair question. Most everything that you will find in this book is maybe not widely known, but is available in public documents. And that's deliberate. That is, I have no business revealing anything that is still classified as secret that, you know, truly is. And ever since I left the White House, I have, any president, former president, is entitled to security briefings. You could have them every day if you wanted. But I chose not to do it for several reasons. Number one, Hillary was the first senator from New York ever to serve on the Armed Services Committee. She had to deal with a lot of the same things. And I'm out here giving talks all the time. I didn't want to inadvertently, you know, do you remember every place you learned, every fact you know that wanders around in your head? I just didn't want to even run the risk that I could inadvertently say something that would cause our country difficulty, any president of either party difficulty, or Hillary difficulty in doing what she was doing. Being on the Armed Services Committee after 9/11 was a pretty dicey deal. Then she became Secretary of State. So I've bent over backwards not to do that. But I also have talked to a lot of people who work in this field with me. I issued the first cybersecurity executive order in 1997, more than 20 years ago, when we were in our, you know, shorts, walking shorts, like little kids. It's much more complicated now. And I think that I got up to speed on right at the edges of what is possible. And I believe that what we tell you could happen, could happen. And we just aren't very good at it. I mean, and if you look at this election thing, there are many, many states whose systems could be easily hacked. There's a national organization that's part of the federal government, but it's non-political, that offers states help. Only two of them have taken it. There are voting machine companies that have machines in states that say you can recount the votes, but you can't get into the machine to see if the software has been tampered with because it interferes with our proprietary information. In other words, your constitutional right is not as important as my commercial interest. Terry McAuliffe got rid of the ones in Virginia after he took one to the hackers convention in Las Vegas, and it was hacked in 6 minutes. So they went to paper ballots. And you should too if you haven't. So anyway, that's just a long way of saying I think we're right on this. I know we're current on it, but some of the details to prove it might require access to classified information that I have deliberately chosen not to get because I don't want to say something I shouldn't, even to you.
So when you are reading thrillers, they inevitably involve the White House or the president or the FBI or the CIA at some point. What do you think when you read just a regular guy writing about that? Do you think, oh, that's bullshit? Or do you sometimes think they're getting pretty close to it?
I have mixed feelings. First of all, some of them are highly unlikely, but good anyway, and you could set it up. Like, I like Alex Berenson's books. You know, I like Daniel Silva's books. I like a lot of the books. You know, Zach Higgins has made a living for decades with, you know, his guys that used to be in the NRA and now work for British intelligence and work for the American president and all that. A lot of the stuff is accurate but improbable. But the stuff that goes into real depth, like there's a special unit that answers only to the president that goes out and kills people you don't want to know about. To the best of my knowledge, that's not happening. And one of the things that Jim was talking about making fun, one of the things that bothers me about Scandal and House of Cards, both of which I have enjoyed, and Shonda Rhimes is a good friend of Hillary's and mine, and I, and that president really did a lot to help my wife, so I'll always vote for him, even though he's a Republican on the show. But it's just not true what these shows tell you, that the, you know, these politicians out there are killing people all the time and getting away with it. I mean, so far, that's not true. And I just, and I wonder if it hasn't affected, if it didn't actually give some more salience to one of Mr. Trump's slogans, "What have you got to lose?" It's like, they're all bad. They all do this. No, they don't. No, they don't. And these people, a lot of these guys that are speaking out now on national security issues are highly ethical, old-fashioned people who love this country and want to do the right thing in the right way.
The opening scene of the book, and this is not giving too much away because it's the opening scene and you're going to read it immediately, is the idea of answering questions from a subcommittee. And clearly that is inspired by you. I mean, you must have supplied the meat for that opening sequence because it is so technically poised from the president's point of view. But it seems to me, to be serious about the politics of it, to cleave to an older-fashioned type of politics where honesty and so on matters. I mean, the whole point of the scene is that the president must conceal something while not stating an obvious falsehood. And that, I read it, it's, the book is just out, but it seemed almost quaint by current standards.
I think we hold to the idea, though, that it isn't quaint and it isn't old-fashioned. And if we get lucky enough to get the kind of leader who can turn us around, that some of these things will come back. That it doesn't have to be a fairy tale.
Yeah, if you look...
There's a real cynical, skeptical view of things right now, and I think it can be at least mildly corrected.
Here's the deal. In all combat, where there's a game on tonight, right? One of the NBA games. With some of the greatest players ever to play the game. In all combat, there's rules, there's referees. You prefer it if they wear black and white shirts and not wear the uniform of the other team. And I've been in games that played it both ways. It, believe me, having them in the uniform of referees is better. But everybody's pushing against the limits of the rules, right? And that has been the case since the beginning. So a lot of this is about our culture and what we permit. And I'm with Jim. I think if you look at a lot of these races, which have been reasonably close but have played out since the election, first of all, they were serious. They were focused on the issues, and the press coverage was not political. That is, it was not determined, here's what I want to say and I will delete or add to get the desired impact. You know, you just tell people what's happening. All you need is a fair press. Just a fair press, just to count what's going on. It was inherently interesting. You saw that in the transgender woman in Virginia. Democrat wins a Republican seat and says, please don't vote for or against me because I'm transgender. Vote for me because you can't get to and from work. The other guy's had 20 years to do something about it, and I'll make it so you can get to work on time, get home, see your kids, and have dinner. I mean, it was a real thing. Sounds almost quaint. It happened. That the guy that got elected to the Senate in Alabama, the Democrat, is an amazing human being. And I appointed him United States Attorney. But he got the Birmingham church bombers going back to the 60s. And he won the old-fashioned way. I mean, he got up there. He didn't want any national press for the campaign. He didn't want anything. He wanted to go out there and tell the people, it's about time somebody showed up for you. And so I think it's not quaint, but here's the problem. If you take too many liberties with democracy and everybody's taking them all at once, and then you have a rise of social media where you have more information and more disinformation, and you can't tell the difference, you run the risk of doing harm that can take decades to recover from. And that's what this is sort of about, as the book opens. And by the way, I didn't do the first draft of that opening. I wish it had been my idea, because I think it's such a great idea to open it, but I did supply a little realism about how it would work and the details, and we worked on all these things together. But
we wrote those chapters about six times back and forth. Those two chapters, yeah.
But I have to confess, I learned a lot working with him, because we'd go along and it's cyber terrorism, so nothing too sexy happens for 30 pages, and all of a sudden, boom, he comes up with a new twist. I thought, God, this guy's good. It's like you. I have found out most people who are really good at what they do did not get there by accident. Almost every, if we say at home, almost every turtle on the fence, folks, was put there. It didn't get there by itself. I'm sitting between two.
You talk about turnarounds, though, and the possibility of it. And I agree with you that, there's some things that work against that. But you will see unity. You will see people coming together in the military. You see it when people are under fire. You will see it in sports. You will see people that normally wouldn't get along. All of a sudden, they do get along. You will see it after something like 9/11, which all of a sudden, we're together. And it is possible. We can come together more than we are now.
Yeah, and let me just say one other thing. I agree with that. We couldn't maintain the unity we felt after 9/11 forever, but we went out of our way. It seemed like to throw it away in a hurry, and that's basically what this book is about. It's not a Pollyanna book that says we shouldn't fight and argue and have disagreements. It's that we need to do it within a range that allows us in the end to get together, make some agreements, and keep America going forward. You wouldn't like it if everybody just sang Kumbaya every day, because we live in a complex time in which, as I say again, diverse groups and the clash of ideas make better decisions than homogenous groups or dictators. You got to have a debate, but the debate has to be, we're going to make this system work. And you got to understand, guys like Putin, for example, they want to discredit democracy everywhere. It's a bad for their business if democracy works. A dictator does well if you think, you the voter, you the citizen, God, I read all this stuff and they're all bad, and one of them is just as bad as the other, and I can't figure out what the truth is. There's so much who's doing fake news and what's real. So, and all you need is somebody who's really good at accusing other people of doing what they're doing. And then all of a sudden, one day you wake up and everybody thinks, well, let's just elect the best autocrat we can, one I feel good about, because I can't make an informed decision. You can't imagine that, but that's what happens. Everybody does that. And every time you fudge those boundaries, you take a risk. And you see a lot of that in this book, where you'll see people doing something you do. You push the limits, but you got to know when to stop, even if nobody's stopping you.
I'm sitting here, I'm trying to think what would be worse, kind of the way things are right now, or a kumbaya world.
Yeah, we don't want either. Can you guys name the person in your early life that produced the careers that you've had? Was there a single mentor, a teacher, a librarian, somebody like that who set you doing what you're doing?
For me, it's my grandmother.
Your grandma?
Yeah. She was just the one that always said, you can You can do what you want to do, except she said you'll never be in the NBA. So forget about it. She said, forget about that dream. But And I've always been big on having a dream and having a backup dream. You know, if you're... Really, I mean, you're a dancer, but you're 211 pounds. You can still dance for your whole life, but you maybe ought to have a backup dream, too. You know? And I always had a backup dream. You know, I always thought it was... presumptuous to think that I could make a living as a novelist.
But it was my grandma, too. She was really the nicest person in my family. So any grandmas here, we love you.
Yeah. Well, you know, I do think it's important. One of the things I like about Jim is he spends so much of his money giving books away and promoting reading programs for young children. My father was killed in a car wreck 3 months before I was born. So for the first 4 years of my life, my mother and I lived with her parents. And most of that time, she was gone. She went back to school to be a nurse. So my grandmother and my grandfather were both intelligent people. My grandmother was really smart, and her brother, who had a sixth grade education, is, I think, the smartest person in our family. But back then, you know, keep in mind, I was born right after World War II in a state with a per capita income roughly half the national average. I didn't know anybody with a college degree except the town doctor at the time. So, but my grandmother, when I was still in a high chair, we had an old wooden house. She tacked playing cards up on the window boards and taught me to read, and then got all those old Dick and Jane readers and had me reading them by the time I was 2 years old. And she just kept shoving books in front of me. And then there weren't many books widely available, so they got the old World Book Encyclopedia and would just read to me from it every night. And they made me think I could learn what I needed to know. Like, we didn't talk about, are you smart or are you dumb? We talked about, will you work and learn? Will you read and absorb? And I think that's really important. I think a lot of people, Jim was talking about a backup plan. I got more music scholarships than academic scholarships in high school. But when I was 16 years old, I looked in the mirror and I said, you're happy playing your saxophone, but be honest, do you ever think you'll be as good as John Coltrane? And maybe that's shooting too high because I think he's the best there ever was, but I said no. And then you had to play. Back then, you could not make a living doing concerts or CDs. In that case, it was LP, the old vinyl records. You had to play the clubs. So you had to stay up all night, sleep half the day. Your chances of being a drug addict were roughly 2 or 3 times greater than your chances of having a successful family. I wanted to be a father. I wanted to have a life. And that's how I got started thinking about other things and got interested in politics. But so my backup plan I went to in the beginning. In the summer, when I was a kid, I played saxophone for 12 hours a day in the summertime till my lips would bleed. But I still knew I wouldn't be the best in the world. And I thought I could be pretty good at this, what I wound up doing.
Do you think that reading is, I mean, I know that you think reading needs help because you do a lot of help in getting kids to read. How do you think that's going now?
How what?
How is it going now, kids reading? Do you think we are winning or holding our own or what?
I don't know. I think we can win. And that's one of the reasons that I really single out reading in terms of kind of everything we do in terms of charities is all about getting kids reading. We have, and I'll give you an example of something I'm very hopeful about. We're down in Florida most of the time, and in Florida, the percentage of kids reading at grade level is 43%. Now, before you get to, you know, number one in the U.S. is Massachusetts at 62%. So nobody's doing all that well. I don't know where Pennsylvania is. But it's somewhere between 43 and 62, so it's not great. At any rate, we have scholarships at the University of Florida, and I met with them, and they're very proactive and smart, and I like the group. And they have tested a program in the Gainesville area where they have it up over 80%, which is unbelievable. And so now I'm working with the University of Florida, and we've gone to the legislature, and they said if we can get it up, they're giving us two counties, and they say if you can get it up into the 70s, we will fund this across the state. And then Florida will, I mean, not that it doesn't really matter, but Florida will have the highest level in the country, and we'll have a model that other states can consider using. So that's, you know, and if you think about it, there's two levels in terms of getting kids reading. One is at-risk kids, which I'm the most passionate about, because if they don't get to the point where they're competent readers, their chances of getting through life, I mean, it's really, really difficult. How are they going to get through high school if they're not competent readers? It's just almost impossible. And we can do something about that in most cases. We really can. And the other thing is just kids who are bright, but getting them to read and think a little more broadly, which is also important. Our son, when Jack was 8, he wasn't a big reader. And, we said to him, you're going to read every day this summer. And he said, do I have to? And we said, yeah, unless you want to live in a garage. But we went out, we got him a dozen or so books and that we knew he'd like. And it ranged from Percy Jackson to Wrinkle in Time. And by the end of the summer, he had read all 12 of the books. And then when he took his SSATs, he got an 800 reading. He got into Penn. He's at Brown, but he's at Penn. No, it was really nip and tuck. But the point of it is that we took a kid who wasn't interested in reading, and he really became a very, very good reader. So it's possible. We can do stuff.
What do you think? Should we be doing more government-wise?
Yeah, I think, first of all, I think the key to improving performance is big emphasis on early childhood learning and reading. It's one of my foundation's main initiatives called Too Small to Fail. And my daughter spearheads it, and she's written two or three children's books lately. And they're good, I think. But I'm not biased. But they did things like they made a partnership with the Coin-Operated Laundry Association, because a lot of single moms use coin-operated laundries, and they put lots of books in them. And we've helped, we work with a partner to create a few dozen new parks that are organized not just for play, but for reading. It tries to complement what Jim does, and I think he talked about Massachusetts. I think that if Massachusetts, for all of its problems there, were a separate country, they'd have the 8th best school system in the world. And they have, you think, oh, well, what do you expect, Harvard and MIT? They got a lot of poor students in Massachusetts, a lot of diversity. But we have to do more, I think, to get kids ready and then to stay with them. And since we're not going to lengthen the school year, apparently, and only Belgium has a shorter school year of any of the wealthy countries than we do. And a lot of these kids lose ground in the summer, so that's why programs like what Jim's doing are so important. The rest of us have got to get together and put together fill-in-the-blanks programs that will have the same impact. Because what he said about reading is important. The real gap in achievement between the United States and other countries starts to appear basically at the beginning of middle school. Our elementary school kids do pretty well in comparative international exams. There are a lot of states that don't drive their kids like they're in a wagon train when they're young. But that's when the longer school year, the more support services, the support for the parents to have time, all that kind of stuff kicks in. So yes, I think we should do that. I also think we need more after-school and summer-school programs.
The key, in my opinion, and it all comes down to being practical, but the key is there are a couple of good plans to deal with this, and the president is aware of that. The key is that a good plan has to meet state and local government, because it can't work unless the state and local government buy into it. They must. And then you can get it done. You just can't get it done unless it's happening in the schools.
But I don't want to get into this because I was a governor 12 years. I spent a lot of time working on this. And Hillary and I helped to rewrite all the school standards in our state when I was governor of Arkansas. But there are some fabulous public schools in this country. And there are some fabulous after-school programs in this country. And just about every challenge has been met by somebody somewhere. But a lot of teachers have been beat down, and a lot of schools have been demoralized. But also, there's not a culture in too many places to copy what works. Whatever line of business you're in, but we were just talking about the Eagles. I got tickled, my daughter's mother-in-law, Marjorie Margolis, is here tonight, and my son-in-law was the happiest I've ever seen him, I think, except when his children were born and he was married when the Eagles won the Super Bowl. But let me just tell you, you build a great football team by examining what everybody else does and filling in the blanks, right? You try to say, I can do this one thing better. You know, Kansas City won the World Series not very long ago with a team that didn't have any superstars because they had a theory, and there was a whole movie made about it. So one of the problems that I completely agree with Jim, but we have to create a culture of copy, because when somebody's doing something that's right, you ought to adopt it and then improve on it instead of pretend like it didn't happen. That's the thing when I was governor that really frustrated me the most. You know, I just tried to get everybody to get together and just keep building on what works. And some places have money problems, some places have other problems, but it makes a difference.
And that's one of the keys with corporations that really are very successful.
Yeah.
They do it around the world. They find out that it works, and they won't accept, well, it won't work here. Yeah, it probably will work around the world in a lot of cases.
But I don't give up on this. This is really a big deal.
Well, I think one of the crazy things is, I mean, we have all these presidential debates, and if you think through them, I don't know why they do it anyway, because it's not about being the presidential debater. But I don't remember cybersecurity really coming up at all, and education almost never comes up, which is crazy. How can education not be like a fundamental question that's in every presidential debate? Who's making up those questions?
One of the intangible things is your success as a storyteller, your success as a retail politician is outstanding. You're probably the best in the world at those particular things. You were in advertising before. Did that give you a key?
Yeah, but I've been clean for over 20 years.
Yeah. But did it give you a key to understanding how people were, what they wanted? Did that help you get a view of how people would respond?
I think the only thing it did for me was really build up my passion to get out of it. You know what it did do? It did teach me that there's an audience, which is really important. I think you did some TV initially, and you just learned there's an audience. And you go into advertising and you used to go, oh, I can do this. And then you do something, and they put it out, and they test it, and nobody paid any attention. You go, okay, I guess I'm not as smart as I think I am, in terms of just getting people's attention and holding their attention, and then saying something that they care to listen to.
So as a politician, you were legendary for bonding with regular folk. Where did that come from? I mean, you were born in a small town.
Yeah, and I'm the last president to be born into a home without a television. Never mind a computer or a television. So, and I had a bunch of Ken folks that were really smart and had no formal education. And nobody could afford a vacation, so our entertainment was storytelling. And I was taught from a young age that everybody has a story, but not everybody can tell it. So you have to look for it. And if you look hard enough, there's a person down there somewhere. And then I was taught that I had to learn to listen to a story before I could tell one and recounted it, you know, lunch or dinner. And it was fabulous. I doubt if I had, if I hadn't been born when I was born, where I was born, I'm not sure I would have ever become president. I also was raised to believe life is tough. And when somebody just knocks a living daylights out of you, you should get up. And that it's far more important, you know, to just, but never stop listening and never stop learning and never stop preaching. It's just what I was taught. It was more important than anything else. And people can tell if you're interested in them. Now, it's harder today because of all the static that's out there, you know, and with people getting siloed and I won't listen to this media or that media. My mother-in-law would have been 99 years old 2 days ago. This is always a very emotional week in my family. This is the 50th anniversary of Robert Kennedy's death, my mother's 92nd birthday, 93rd birthday, 95th birthday, I'll get it right, 95th birthday, my mother-in-law's 99th birthday. But anyway, you know, it was very interesting when I was around these people who grew up in a different time, watching them bend but not break, and looking beneath the surface to find the story. People can tell if you care. And I hope when they read this book, you'll think you got a president who really cares about you. Whether you like him or not, whether you agree with him or not, that he's on the level. That's what I hope you think.
My mother-in-law is 97 and she's still driving, so watch out. You know, my father grew up in a Newburgh poorhouse called the Pogey, and his mother was a charwoman there. She cleaned up the bathrooms and the kitchen, and for that duty, she and my father got one room in the poorhouse. That's how they grew up. And that's why I believe I should be the next president of the United States.
That, you know, Patterson really is, we're both pretty schlocky. But he grew up in Newburgh, New York, which was the town that housed George Washington's revolutionary headquarters for most of the Revolutionary War. And he took his lessons well. It's been really fun working with him. I don't like cynical people. I like people that keep thinking they can do better every day. That's the other thing I was going to tell you. This is the 50th anniversary of Robert Kennedy's death. So I was in Arlington Cemetery today with his family, and we observed it. And the thing I liked about Kennedy was he'd go to Appalachia and into Bedford-Stuyvesant. He'd go into, you know, the Intermountain West, where they didn't have any Democrats, and then go to the Native American reservations, and he always said the same thing. And sooner or later, people kind of liked it, that this guy was saying stuff, whether you liked it or not, he was just telling you, here I am. I like that. I think we're getting back there. I think, you know, we go and the pendulum swings, but I think Americans are inherently practical people. And I don't think we'll give up our liberties lightly, but we could lose them while we're preoccupied with something else. That's what I want you to think about. That's why this is important.
This is a very clappy audience. I like that. Very clappy audience.
Good questions from them as well, and one for you, which is, it looks like this book might sell a few copies, and so...
I'm sorry, what was that?
It looks like this book might sell a few copies, so would you consider doing a sequel?
As I said earlier, I mean, we really have had a lot of fun doing this, and we're having a lot of fun going out, and we'll see. I mean, you know, it's If I think if we came up with another idea that we loved, I mean, we'd think about it. I know the president is considering his own detective series now.
Wow. Welcome to the dark side. Go for it.
It's an ex-president who becomes a detective. It's very believable.
Yeah. Well, they got to do something, right?
First of all, I feel so grateful that I got to do this. I mean, I may read 100 mysteries a year in addition to the serious books. You know, I could be here for 3 hours talking to you about Jack Richer. I mean, we could talk about it in the books and everything. I love this stuff. And I feel like Jim just kind of let me go to school for free. And I had a one-on-one tutorial.
Oh, okay.
What? He was wonderful to work with. I loved it. But I've been so nervous about this. You know, the best birthday card I ever got since I turned 60, which is a long time ago now, was there's a circus, and you're under the tent, and they've got the high wire there, you know, and there's a dog about to go across the high wire on a unicycle with a pack full of boxes, just to see what he's going to do. And he says, whatever the dog's name was, is nervous because he's an old dog and this is a new trick. So I'm just an old dog doing a new trick. And even so, I'm just hoping it comes out all right, if you like it and the public likes it, and we have something we think we can make a similar contribution doing, maybe we will, but it's too soon to say.
So the last question from the audience is for the president. The audience member saw you on television and is wondering, what is the bracelet that you're wearing on your right wrist?
Well, as you can see, it's pretty worn off. I've worn this bracelet since June the 24th, 2002. And it was given to me by a native Colombian Indian on the tarmac at the Cartagena, Colombia airport. During a transition between the president, the last Colombian president I served with as president, Mr. Pastrana, and his successor, Mr. Uribe, who was succeeded by President Santos, the man who made the peace agreement in Colombia, and now they just voted for a new one. So it was a long time ago. I wear it to remind myself that I never have a bad day, because this was given to me by a group called Los Niños de Vallenato, the Children of Vallenato. They sing the native folk music of the Colombian state of Cesar, which is the center for all the narco trafficking and the FARC violence that this peace agreement is supposed to end. And these children became phenomenal. They have a music festival every summer in which 10, 20, 30,000 people participate, and they take the very best ones and they form this group. So they were represented by a woman who became a friend of mine, the culture minister of Colombia. Can you imagine this? Colombia has a culture minister, and she was so well known, she was only called by her first name, Consuelo. I adored her, and I liked her family. I liked her husband. I liked her kids. And she brought these kids to sing at the White House. And the narco traffickers hated them because they had a number one hit in Colombia. It was all about ending the drug trafficking and the violence. And they couldn't kill these kids. So they kidnapped her and they murdered her. On September the 23rd, 2001, so we were all caught up in 9/11, right? Right as the children were about to go out on stage at the Kennedy Center in Washington. Okay, I was overseas. I couldn't go to her funeral. So I spoke to her funeral. It was held in the soccer stadium. And if I had to pour, 100,000 people came to the memorial service for a culture minister because she stood for peace and stuck for those kids. So when I went down there, I said, I'll come, but I want you to bring the children to see me. And they were there with the Native Colombian who wrote this, and the new culture minister, the 30-year-old niece of the murdered woman. They're very brave people, the Colombians. They have suffered greatly, and they never quit working for peace. So when you think we can't get along with our neighbors, remember that. Not so very long ago, one-third of that country was in the hands of a foreign power. The narco traffickers and their henchmen, a third. Can you imagine what we'd feel like if a third of Rhode Island, our smallest state, belonged to a foreign power? That's why I wear this. I never have a bad day. I think about those children and what they endured, and I think about my friend and the life she laid down, and I get out of my pity party and rear back and go on. So I recommend all of you find something like this. It's been a great thing.
Well, just like Jack Reacher, I can tell the time in my head, and it's now about 8:34, and we're supposed to be wrapping up. So I would say congratulations on a really, really good book. I read it about a month ago, and I was really nervous about reading it because suppose it wasn't as good as it should have been. But I was immensely relieved. It is actually better than it should have been. And I say that with tremendous regret because it's not from my publishing house, but congratulations, good luck, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.